Chapter 88. In which some people are precocious, others professional, and others mysterious. All in their several ways, it may have been the restless remembrance of what he had seen and heard overnight, or it may have been no deeper mental operation than the discovery that he had nothing to do, which caused Mr. Bailey, on the following afternoon, to feel particularly disposed for agreeable society, and prompted him to pay a visit to his friend Paul Sweetlepipe. On the little bell giving clamorous notice of a visitor's approach, for Mr. Bailey came in at the door with a lunch, to get as much sound out of the bell as possible, Paul Sweetlepipe desisted from the contemplation of a favorite owl, and gave his young friend hearty welcome. "Why, you look smarter by day," said Paul, "than you do by candlelight. I never see such a tight young dasher. Polly. How's our fair friend, Sarah?" "Oh, she's pretty well," said Paul. "She's at home." "There's the remains of a fine woman about Sarah, Paul," observed Mr. Bailey, with genteel indifference. Thought Paul, "he's old. He must be very old." "Too much crumb, you know," said Mr. Bailey. "Too fat, Paul. But there's many worse at her time of life, the very owl's a-opening his eyes." Thought Paul. "I don't wonder at it in a bird of his opinions." He happened to have been sharpening his razors, which were lying open in a row, while a huge strop dangled from the wall. Glancing at these preparations, Mr. Bailey stroked his chin, and a thought appeared to occur to him. "Paul," he said, "I ain't as neat as I could wish about the gills. Being here, I may as well have a shave, and get trimmed close." The barber stood aghast, but Mr. Bailey divested himself of his neckcloth, and sat down in the easy shaving chair with all the dignity and confidence in life. There was no resisting his manner. The evidence of sight and touch became as nothing. His chin was as smooth as a new-laid egg or a scraped Dutch cheese, but Paul Sweetlepipe wouldn't have ventured to deny, on affidavit, that he had the beard of a Jewish rabbi. "Go with the grain, Paul, all round please," said Mr. Bailey, screwing up his face for the reception of the latter. "You may do what you like with the bits of whisker. I don't care for 'em." The meek little barber stood gazing at him with the brush and soap dish in his hand, stirring them round and round in a ludicrous uncertainty, as if he were disabled by some fascination from beginning. At last he made a dash at Mr. Bailey's cheek. Then he stopped again, as if the ghost of a beard had suddenly receded from his touch. But receiving mild encouragement from Mr. Bailey, in the form of an adjuration to go in and win, he lathered him bountifully. Mr. Bailey smiled through the suds in his satisfaction. "Gently over the stones, Paul. Go a tiptoe over the pimples." Paul Sweetlepipe obeyed, and scraped the lather off again with particular care. Mr. Bailey squinted at every successive dab, as it was deposited on a cloth on his left shoulder, and seemed, with a microscopic eye, to detect some bristles in it, for he murmured more than once, "Reether redder than I could wish, Paul." The operation being concluded, Paul fell back and stared at him again, while Mr. Bailey, wiping his face on the jack towel, remarked that arter late hours nothing freshened up a man so much as a easy shave. He was in the act of tying his cravat at the glass, without his coat, and Paul had wiped his razor, ready for the next customer, when Mrs. Gamp, coming downstairs, looked in at the shop door, to give the barber neighborly good day. Feeling for her unfortunate situation, in having conceived a regard for himself which it was not in the nature of things that he could return, Mr. Bailey hastened to soothe her with words of kindness. "Hello," he said, "Sarah. I needn't ask you how you've been this long time, for you're in full bloom. All a blowin' and a growin', ain't she, Polly?" Why, drat the brage and boldness of that boy. Cried Mrs. Gamp, though not displeased. What a imprint young sparrow it is. I wouldn't be that creature's mother not for £50. Mr. Bailey regarded this as a delicate confession of her attachment, and a hint that no pecuniary gain could recompense her for its being rendered hopeless. He felt flattered. Disinterested affection is always flattering. Ah, dear. Moaned Mrs. Gamp, sinking into the shaving chair, that there blessed bull, Mr. Sweetlepipe, has done his worry best to conquer me. Of all the trying annoyances in this wally of the shatter, that one beats him black and blue. It was the practice of Mrs. Gamp, and her friends in the profession, to say this of all the easy customers, as having at once the effect of discouraging competitors for office, and accounting for the necessity of high living on the part of the nurses. Talk of constitution. Mrs. Gamp observed. A person's constitution need be made of bricks to stand it. Mrs. Harris justly says to me, but t'other day, oh, Sari Gamp, she says, how is it done? Mrs. Harris, ma'am, I says to her, we gives no trust ourselves, and puts a deal o' trust Elsevier. These is our religious feelings, and we find some answer. Sari, says Mrs. Harris, such is life. Which likewise is the end of all things. The barber gave a soft murmur, as much as to say that Mrs. Harris's remark, though perhaps not quite so intelligible as could be desired from such an authority, did equal honor to her head, and to her heart. And here, continued Mrs. Gamp, and here am I a-going 20 mile in distant, on as wentersome a chance as ever any one as monthly'd ever run, I do believe. Says Mrs. Harris, with a woman's and a mother's heart a-beatin' in her human breast, she says to me, you're not a-goin', Sari, Lord forgive you. Why am I not a-goin', Mrs. Harris? I replies, Mrs. Gill, I says, woe's never wrong with six, and is it likely, ma'am, I ask you as a mother, that she will begin to be unreglar now? Often and often have I heard him say, I says to Mrs. Harris, meaning Mr. Gill, that he would back his wife a Jen Moore's almanac, to name the very day and hour, for 9 pence farthing. Is it likely, ma'am, I says, as she will fail this once? Says Mrs. Harris, no, ma'am, not in the course of matter. But, she says, the tears a-fillin' in her eyes, you knows much better than me, with your experience, how little puts us out. A punch's show, she says, a chimney sweep, a Newfoundland dog, or a drunken man a common round the corner sharp may do it. So it may, Mr. Sweetlepipes, said Mrs. Gamp, there's no denaging of it, and though my books is clear for a full week, I takes a anxious art along with me, I do assure you, sir. You're so full of zeal, you see. Said Paul. You were it yourself so. Were it myself. Cried Mrs. Gamp, raising her hands and turning up her eyes. You speak truth in that, sir, if you never speaks no more twixt this, and when two Sundays jines together. I feels the sufferings of other people more than I feels my own, though no one mayn't suppage it. The families I've had, said Mrs. Gamp, if all was nowed, and credit done where credit's due, would take a week, to christen at St. Polge's Fountain. Where's the patient going? Asked Sweetlepipe. Into Herefordshire, which is his native air. But native airs nor native graces neither, Mrs. Gamp observed, won't bring him round. So bad as that? Inquired the wistful barber. Indeed. Mrs. Gamp shook her head mysteriously, and pursed up her lips. There's fevers of the mind, she said, as well as body. You may take your slime drafts till you files into the air with effervescence, but you won't cure that. " said the barber, opening his eyes, and putting on his raven aspect. "Lore. " "No. You may make yourself as light as any gash balloon," " said Mrs. Gamp. "But talk, when you're wrong in your head, and when you're in your sleep, of certain things, and you'll be heavy in your mind." "Of what kind of things now?" "Inquired Pole, greedily biting his nails in his great interest. "Ghosts?" Mrs. Gamp, who perhaps had been already tempted further than she had intended to go by the barber's stimulating curiosity, gave a sniff of uncommon significance, and said, "It didn't signify. I may go down with my patient in the coach this afternoon," she proceeded. "I may going to stop with him a day or so, till he gets a country nuss, drat them country nusses, much the orchard hussies knows about their business, and then I may come and back, and that's my trouble, Mr. Sweetlepipes. But I hope that everything'll only go on right and comfortable, as long as I'm away, purwison which, as Mrs. Harris says, Mrs. Gill is welcome to choose her own time. All times of the day and night being equally the same to me." During the progress of the foregoing remarks, which Mrs. Gamp had addressed exclusively to the barber, Mr. Bailey had been tying his cravat, getting on his coat, and making hideous faces at himself in the glass. Being now personally addressed by Mrs. Gamp, he turned round and mingled in the conversation. "You ain't been in the city, I suppose, sir, since we was all three there together," said Mrs. Gamp, "at Mr. Chuzzlewit's?" "Yes, I have, Sarah. I was there last night." "Last night? cried the barber. "Yes, Paul, reether so. You can call it this morning, if you like to be particular. He dined with us." "Who does that young limb mean by us?" said Mrs. Gamp, with most impatient emphasis. "Me and my governor, Sarah. He dined at our house. We was very merry, Sarah. So much so, that I was obliged to see him home in a hackney coach at 3 o'clock in the morning." It was on the tip of the boy's tongue to relate what had followed, but remembering how easily it might be carried to his master's ears, and the repeated cautions he had had from Mr. Crimple not to chatter, he checked himself, adding, "Only, she was sitting up, expecting him." "And all things considered," said Mrs. Gamp sharply, "she might have knowed better than to go a-tearing herself out by doing anything of the sort. Did they seem pretty pleasant together, sir?" "Oh, yes, answered Bailey, pleasant enough." "I'm glad on it," said Mrs. Gamp, with a second sniff of significance. "They haven't been married so long," observed Paul, rubbing his hands, "that they need be anything but pleasant yet a while." "No," said Mrs. Gamp, with a third significant signal. "Especially," pursued the barber, "when the gentleman bears such a character as you gave him. I speak, as I find, Mr. Sweetlepipes," said Mrs. Gamp. "Forbid it should be other ways. But we never knows what's hidden in each other's hearts, and if we had glass winders there, we'd need keep the shutters up, some on us, I do assure you." "But you don't mean to say Paul Sweetlepipe began." "No," said Mrs. Gamp, cutting him very short, "I don't. Don't think I do. The tortures of the imposition shouldn't make me own I did. All I says is," added the good woman, rising and folding her shawl about her, "that the bull's a-waitin', and the precious moments is a-flyin' fast." The little barber having in his eager curiosity a great desire to see Mrs. Gamp's patient, proposed to Mr. Bailey that they should accompany her to the bull and witness the departure of the coach. That young gentleman assenting, they all went out together. Arriving at the tavern, Mrs. Gamp, who was full dressed for the journey in her latest suit of mourning, left her friends to entertain themselves in the yard, while she ascended to the sick room, where her fellow laborer Mrs. Prigg was dressing the invalid. He was so wasted, that it seemed as if his bones would rattle when they moved him. His cheeks were sunken, and his eyes unnaturally large. He lay back in the easy chair like one more dead than living, and rolled his languid eyes towards the door when Mrs. Gamp appeared, as painfully as if their weight alone were burdensome to move. "And how are we by this time?" " Mrs. Gamp observed. "We looks charming." "We looks a deal charminger than we are, then," returned Mrs. Prigg, a little chafed in her temper. "We got out of bed backards, I think, for we're as cross as two sticks. I never see sich a man. He wouldn't have been washed, if he'd had his own way." "She put the soap in my mouth," said the unfortunate patient feebly. "Couldn't you keep it shut then?" retorted Mrs. Prigg. "Who do you think's to wash one feeder, and miss another, and wear one's eyes out with all manner of fine work of that description, for half a crown a day? If he wants to be titivated, you must pay accordin'." Cried the patient, "Oh dear, dear. Said Mrs. Prigg. "That's the way he's been a conductin' of himself, Sarah, ever since I got him out of bed, if you'll believe it." Instead of being grateful, Mrs. Gamp observed, "for all our little ways." "Oh, fie for shame, sir, fie for shame." Here Mrs. Prick seized the patient by the chin, and began to rasp his unhappy head with a hairbrush. "I suppose you don't like that, neither." She observed, stopping to look at him. It was just possible that he didn't, for the brush was a specimen of the hardest kind of instrument producible by modern art, and his very eyelids were red with the friction. Mrs. Prigg was gratified to observe the correctness of her supposition, and said triumphantly she knowed as much. When his hair was smoothed down comfortably into his eyes, Mrs. Prigg and Mrs. Gamp put on his neckerchief, adjusting his shirt collar with great nicety, so that the starched points should also invade those organs, and afflict them with an artificial ophthalmia. His waistcoat and coat were next arranged, and as every button was wrenched into a wrong buttonhole, and the order of his boots was reversed, he presented on the whole rather a melancholy appearance. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.